The German, Kurt, was slumped in the pilot seat, his pistol in his lap, snoring softly. His red shirt unbuttoned to the waist, and his muscular hairy chest rising and falling with each breath. He was unshaven, and the lank black hair fell over his eyes. She could smell his sweat, and somehow that excited her, and she studied him carefully. There was an air of cruelty and brutality about him, the machismo of the revolutionary, which always attracted her strongly, had perhaps been the original reason for her radical leaning so many years ago. Suddenly she wanted him very badly. However, when she woke him with a hand down the front of his thin linen slacks, he was bleary-eyed and foul-breathed, and not even her skilful kneading could arouse him, and in a minute she turned away with an exclamation of disgust. As a displacement activity, she picked up the microphone, switched on the loudspeakers of the passenger cabins. She knew she was acting irrationally, but she began to speak. "Now listen to me, everybody. I have something very important to tell you." Suddenly she was angry with them. They were of the class that had devised and instituted the manifestly unjust and sick society against which she was in total rebellion. They were the fat, complacent bourgeoisie. They were like her father, and she hated them as she hated her father. As she began to speak, she realized that they would not even understand the language she was using, the language of the new political order, and her anger and frustration against them and their society mounted. She didn't realize she was raving until suddenly she heard, as from afar, the shriek of outrage in her own voice, like the death wail of a mortally wounded animal, and she stopped abruptly. She felt giddy and light-headed, so she had to clutch at the desktop for support, and her heart banged wildly against her ribs. She was panting as though she'd run a long way, and it took nearly a full minute for her to bring herself under control. When she spoke again, her tone was still ragged and breathless. "It is now 9 o'clock," she said. "If we do not hear from the tyrant within 3 hours, I shall be forced to begin executing hostages." 3 hours, she repeated ominously. "Only 3 hours." Now she prowled the aircraft like a big cat paces along the bars of its cage as feeding time approaches. 2 hours, she told them, and the passengers shrank away from her as she passed. 1 hour. There was a bright, sadistic splinter of anticipation in her voice. "We will choose the first hostages now." "But you promised," pleaded the fat little doctor, as Ingrid pulled his wife out of her seat and the Frenchman hustled her forward towards the flight deck. Ingrid ignored him and turned to Karen. "Get children, a boy and a girl," she instructed. "Oh yes, and the pregnant one. Let them see her big belly. They won't be able to resist that." Karen herded the hostages into the forward galley and forced them at pistol point to sit in a row upon the fold-down aircrew seats. The door to the flight deck was open, and Ingrid's voice carried clearly to the galley as she explained to the Frenchman Henri, speaking in English. "It is of the utmost importance that we do not allow a deadline to pass without retaliating strongly. If we miss one deadline, then our credibility is destroyed. It will only be necessary once. We must show the steel at least once. They must learn that every one of our deadlines are irrevocable, not negotiable." The girl began to cry. She was 13 years old, able to understand the danger. The plump doctor's wife put her arm around her shoulders and hugged her gently. "Speedbird 070, the radio squawked suddenly. "We have a message for Ingrid." "Go ahead, Tara, this is Ingrid." She had jumped up to take the microphone, pushing the door to the flight deck closed. "The negotiator for the British and American governments has proposals for your consideration. Are you ready to copy?" "Negative." Ingrid's voice was flat and emphatic. "I say again, negative. Tell the negotiator I will talk only face to face, and tell him we are only 40 minutes to the noon deadline. He had better get out here fast," she warned. She hooked the microphone and turned to Henri. "All right. We will take the pills now. It has truly begun at last. It was another cloudless day. Brilliant sunlight that was flung back in piercing darts of light from the bare metal parts of the aircraft. The heat came up through the soles of his shoes and burned down upon Peter's bare neck. The forward hatch opened, as it had before, when Peter's stride was halfway across the tarmac. This time there were no hostages on display. The hatchway was a dark, empty square. Suppressing the urge to hurry, Peter carried himself with dignity, head up, jaw clenched firmly. He was 50 yards from the aircraft when the girl stepped into the opening. She stood with indolent grace, her weight all on one leg, the other cocked slightly, long, bare, brown legs. She carried the big shot pistol on one hip, and the cartridge belt emphasized the narrow waist. She watched Peter come on with a half-smile on her lips. Suddenly a medallion of light appeared on her chest, a dazzling speck like a brilliant insect, and she glanced down at it contemptuously. "This is provocation," she called. Clearly she knew that the bright speck was the beam thrown by the laser sight of one of the marksmen covering her from the airport building. A few ounces more of pressure on the trigger would send a .222 bullet crashing precisely into that spot, tearing her heart and lungs to bloody shreds. Peter felt a flare of anger at the sniper who had activated his laser sight without the order. But his anger was tempered by reluctant admiration for the girl's courage. She could sneer at that mark of certain death upon her breast. Peter made a cutout sign with his right hand, and almost immediately the speck of light disappeared as the gunner switched off his laser sight. "That's better," the girl said, and she smiled, running her gaze appraisingly down Peter's body. "You've a good shape, baby," she said, and Peter's anger flared again under her scrutiny. "Nice flat belly," she said. "Good legs, and you didn't get all those muscles sitting at a desk and pushing a pen." She pursed her lips thoughtfully. "You know, I think you're a cop or a soldier. That's what I think, baby. I think you're a goddamn pig." Her voice had a new, harsh quality, and the skin seemed drier and drawn, older than it had been before. He was close enough now to see the peculiar diamante glitter in her eyes, and he recognized the tension that seemed to rack her body, the abrupt, restless gestures. She was onto drugs now, he was certain of it. He was dealing with a political fanatic with a long history of violence and death, whose remaining humane traits would now be entirely suppressed by the high of stimulant drugs. He knew she was more dangerous now than a wounded wild animal, a cornered leopard, a man-eating shark with a taste of blood, exciting it to the killing frenzy. He didn't reply, but held her gaze steadily, keeping his hands in view, coming to a halt below the open hatchway. He waited quietly for her to begin, and the itch of the drug in her blood would not allow her to stand still. She fidgeted with the weapon in her hands, touched the camera still dangling from around her neck. Cyril Watkins had tried to tell him something about that camera, and suddenly Peter realized what it was. "The trigger for the fuses," he pondered as he waited. Almost certainly, he decided. That was why it was with her every moment. She saw the direction of his eyes and dropped her hand guiltily, confirming his conclusion. "Are the prisoners ready to leave?" she demanded. "Is the gold packed? Is the statement ready for transmission?" "The South African government has acceded to urgent representations by the governments of Great Britain and the United States of America." "Good," she nodded. "As an act of common humanity, the South Africans have agreed to release all the persons on your list of detainees and banned persons." "Yes." "They will be flown to any country of their choice."
"And the gold?"
"The South African government refuses categorically to finance or to arm an unconstitutional foreign-based opposition. They refuse to provide funds for the persons freed under this agreement."
"The television transmission?"
"The South African government considers the statement to be untrue in substance and in fact, and to be extremely prejudicial to the maintenance of law and order in this country. It refuses to allow transmission of the statement. They have accepted only one of our demands. The girl's voice took on an even more strident tone, and her shoulders jerked in an uncontrolled spasm. The release of political detainees and banned persons is subject to one further condition, Peter cut in swiftly. And what is that? The girl demanded. Two livid, burning spots of colour had appeared in her cheeks. In return for the release of political prisoners, they demand the release of all hostages, not only the women and children, all persons aboard the aircraft, and they will guarantee safe passage for you and all members of your party to leave the country with the released detainees. The girl flung back her head, the thick golden mane flying wildly about her head as she screeched with laughter. The laughter was a wild, almost maniacal sound, and though it went on, there was no echo of mirth in her eyes. They were fierce as eagle's eyes as she laughed. The laughter was cut off abruptly, and her voice was suddenly flat and level. So they think they can make demands, do they? They think they can draw the teeth from the UN proposals, do they? They think that without hostages to account for, the fascist governments of Britain and America can again cast their veto with impunity. Peter made no reply. Answer me, she screamed suddenly. They do not believe we are serious, do they? I'm a messenger only, he said. You're not, she screamed in accusation. You're a trained killer. You're a pig. She lifted the pistol and aimed with both hands at Peter's face. What answer must I take back? Peter asked, without in any way acknowledging the aim of the weapon. An answer. Her voice again dropped to an almost conversational level. Of course, an answer. She lowered the pistol and consulted the stainless steel Japanese watch on her wrist. It's 3 minutes past noon, 3 minutes past the deadline, and they are entitled to an answer, of course. She looked around her with an almost bewildered expression. The drug was having side effects, Peter guessed. Perhaps she had overdosed herself. Perhaps whoever had prescribed it had not taken into account the 48 sleepless hours of strain that preceded its use. The answer, he prodded her gently, not wanting to provoke another outburst. Yes, wait, she said, and disappeared abruptly into the gloom of the interior. Karen was standing over the four hostages on the fold-down seats. She looked round at Ingrid with smouldering dark eyes. Ingrid nodded once curtly, and Karen turned back to her prisoners. Come, she said softly, we are going to let you go now. Almost gently she lifted the pregnant woman to her feet with a hand on her shoulder. Ingrid left her and passed swiftly into the rear cabins. She nodded again to Kurt, and with a toss of his head he flicked the lank locks of hair from his eyes and thrust the pistol into his belt. From the locker above his head he brought down two of the plastic grenades. Holding one in each fist, he pulled the pins with his teeth and held the rings hooked over his little fingers. With his arms spread like a crucifix, he ran lightly down the aisle. These grenades are primed. Nobody must move. Nobody must leave their seats. No matter whatever happens, stay where you are. The fourth hijacker took up the cry from him, holding primed grenades in both hands above his head. Nobody move. No talking. Sit still. Everybody still. He repeated in German and in French, and his eyes had the same hard, glossy glitter of the drug high. Ingrid turned back towards the flight deck. Come, sweetheart. She placed an arm round the girl's shoulder, shepherding her towards the open hatchway, but the child shrank away from her with dread. Don't touch me, she whispered, and her eyes were huge with terror. The boy was younger, more trusting. He took Ingrid's hand readily. He had thick curly hair and honey-brown eyes as he looked up at her. Is my daddy here? He asked. Yes, darling. Ingrid squeezed his hand. You be a good boy now, and you'll see your daddy very soon. She led him to the open hatchway. Stand there, she said.